DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, your one-stop shop, or shall I say milk bar, for all the latest in science and technology, because this week we're down at the farm. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, as part of this special edition of Spectrum, we're looking at farming today and tomorrow, and the point at which science and nature meet, and the battle lines are drawn at the UK's first GM trial in a decade.
I think the Rothamsted trial may well have been a turning point in terms of public opinion, and people are not in favour of destroying scientific experiments before the results can be yielded.
Also on the programme, aquaponics in Berlin, using fish waste to fertilise plants that in turn clean the water for the fish.
That you can feed a whole nation with this, I don't think so. But in urban space, like in Berlin, there's so much space which is not used. And so I think it's really probably a solution.
Then, that's the sex life of a cow, of course. And we tried to find out whether it's possible to download green fingers and turn our plant-killing reporter into a saviour of domestic vegetation. You'll see, it's a good job we didn't ask her to try it out on domestic pets. All that and more right here on Spectrum. The first open-air trial of GM crops in a decade has begun in Britain to much controversy. Predictably, you might say. Well, the site, which is at the world-famous Rothamsted Research Centre near London, has been the target of protests, vandalism and even cyber attacks. But the scientists have fought back with a media campaign to explain how a new generation of GM technology could help tomorrow's farmers and consumers. Robin Powell went to Rothamsted to find out more.
Well, these are the plants, these are wheat plants that we've transplanted from our little culture pots in the tissue culture lab. The odd white label you can see are non-GM plants, and all the yellow ones are GM.
I'm being led through the high-tech laboratories and glasshouses of the Rothamsted Research Centre, just outside London. The aim of their experiment is to see what effect wheat plants that emit the E-beta-farnesene pheromone have on aphid behaviour in the wild. Professor Hugh Jones is a leading member of the team here, undertaking probably the most high-profile experiment in the centre's 169-year history.
So these plants that you're looking at now are the plants that contain the aphid alarm genes. There's two types of plants. One makes about 10 times more of the aphid alarm signal chemical than the other. So we're comparing the rates of emission of the E-beta-farnesene in these two types.
Although experiments on GM crops are common in the lab, this GM wheat has been growing in a field near the research centre, in the open air, the first such trial in the UK in a decade. If the aphids stay away, as they did in the lab, it could save the plants from pest damage and reduce the need for pesticides. The head of the research team, John Pickett, says it shows a new type of genetic engineering at work.
I think this is a so-called paradigm shift, because what we've been doing in the past is really using genes to make proteins. Now, what we're doing is we're putting genes for enzymes into the plant, and then the enzymes make the chemical that we're interested in.
However, talk of a next generation of GM crops doesn't impress critics of the experiment. They're adamant that the pollen from the GM wheat should not be allowed to fertilise conventional crops in the area. In May, the campaign group Take the Flower Back threatened to destroy the GM wheat during a protest near the site. The protesters were kept out by local police. Private security contractors still guard the field, which is also surrounded by high metal fencing. The Rothamsted scientists say that they've done everything they can to minimise the risk of cross-pollination, including buffer zones of barley and conventional wheat around the GM crop, as well as choosing a wheat variety that pollinates later in the year than most local varieties. But that doesn't convince Pete Riley from the campaign group GM Freeze.
The risk of contamination by pollen by wheat is low, but it's not zero. Some of it does actually cross-pollinate through wind. And there's scientific papers from Canada where they track GM pollen from wheat and found it had 2.75 kilometres away. So the idea that it's completely contained within the field is a nonsense. From our perspective, the real risks come if you actually commercialise it, and the evidence from the USA is that it's going to be extremely difficult to ensure that choice for people who want to remain GM-free is available.
Writer and environmentalist Mark Linus used to oppose GM, but is now a supporter. He believes the argument that the public has a right to choose between GM and non-GM is outdated. and he praises the media campaign by Rothamsted to counter long-standing opposition to GM in the UK.
I think the Rothamsted trial may well have been a turning point in terms of public opinion, because not just the media, but most of the opinions I saw expressed from the general public were in favour of the scientists about this. So the debate was framed not in the sense of are you pro or anti-GM, which might have had a different answer, but are you pro or anti-destroying scientific research? And people are not in favour of destroying scientific experiments before the results can be yielded.
Rothamsted's John Pickett agrees.
As a scientist, I can only say that I very much hope it represents a turning point. But basically, it's a good deal lower risk that we're talking about from any kind of GM operation than the risk we have of not providing the new technologies for new ways of producing food sustainably and as a healthy product.
So can new GM crop strains, of which the Rothamsted wheat trial is only one example, help feed an increasingly populated and hungry world, as Pickett suggests? Those most familiar with hunger in the developing world aren't so sure. Duncan Green is Senior Strategic Advisor at the UK-based charity Oxfam.
So Oxfam is not for or against GM. We're sceptical, certainly, because of our experience on the ground. But what we're saying is that the decisions on GM have to be taken by the farmers and by the people closest to the farmers, and that would be national governments. And that needs to be the test of any new technology. Is it going to help that poorest group of people who are living on less than $1.25 a day? And that's our big question on GM.
The answer to that most important question may become clearer in 2 years' time when the results of the Rothamsted GM wheat trial are published. Robin Powell for DW at the Rothamsted Research Centre near London.
Over the past few years, attention has been drawn to reducing CO2 emissions from food production, which means, of course, reducing food miles by growing and buying food locally. In the German capital, Berlin, there's been an increasing trend towards urban gardening and urban farming, from small-scale DIY groups to independent companies utilising high-tech systems. One such system which is garnering a lot of interest at the moment is aquaponics. It's a sustainable system that combines aquaculture and hydroponics. Put simply, fish and plants are cultivated in a recirculated ecosystem where the fish waste fertilises the plants and the plants clean the water. Our research into this system began in the 1970s. It's a challenge to get the system working just right. In Berlin, Efficient City Farming, or ECF, have just launched their aquaponics prototype, built in a disused shipping container. Cinnamon Nippert went along to check it out.
As in all life, this water is part of an essential circular system.
Welcome to the container farm. You have the water tank where the fish are in. And from the water tank, the water runs into the Dortmund well. It's a natural filter where the sediment in the water basically goes down to the ground. And the cleaned water runs to the next filter.
That's Nicholas Leschke, CEO of Efficient City Farming, or ECF. He explains how the ammonium in the water is turned into nitrate via a particular filter that looks a little bit like hair curlers.
They turn the ammonium, which is in the water, into nitrate. And nitrate is the fertilizer for the plants. And from here it runs into a nutrition tank filled with the water that is enriched for the plants with fertilizer. And from there it goes up to the hydroponic farm, or the hydroponic system.
The ECF uses the Leibniz Institute IGB's ASTAF Pro aquaponics system, and it's CO2 neutral. While the prototype really is in a shipping container, ECF has bigger plans for an old malt factory, the Malzfabrik, in Berlin's Schöneberg district.
We are working on the urban farming city centre, which we want to install here at the Malzfabrik. And that farm will be around 1,000 square meter vegetable production greenhouse and about 800 square meter fish production.
When it comes to the environmental savings, Leschke has more precise figures.
70% of fresh water used by humans is used in agriculture. And some of the food that we actually eat have a very bad water footprint. For example, I really like beef. But 1 kilo beef has a water footprint of 15,500 liters. That's a lot of water. And also the food footprint actually of beef is quite bad. Like for example, to produce 1 kilo of beef, you need 130 kilos of food. So if you take a fish, for example, which is much more efficient in that sense, the water footprint is about 1,000 liters in aquaculture, and the food footprint is about 1 kilo of food is 1 kilo of fish, roughly.
ECF have chosen to farm perch fish because they're tough and pretty easy to take care of. At the open day, they invited people to sponsor a fish which they can choose to pick up and take home to cook or enjoy it at the end of summer barbecue. Lots of people, including Yvonne from Guatemala, are sponsoring a fish and have been asked to write a short message on the side of the container.
And what did you call your fish?
Belcat. And that's actually a name of a friend back in Guatemala. So I'm pretty sure he'll like that.
And tell me the message that you wrote to Berka.
Oh, well, I actually wrote my message in Spanish because I wanted to take a picture of it and show my friend in Guatemala what I wrote. And it basically says, Ben and Yvonne, that's my boyfriend and me, we both actually bought the fish together, have a fish, and his name is Berka. And then it says, we love you.
And what do you think of the container farm?
I think it's interesting because you can use space which probably in cities or urban space is useless. So, and also what I like is like regional products, so that the products come locally.
So you think this is kind of the way of the future, urban farming?
I don't think so. So that you can feed a whole nation with this, I don't think so. But in urban space, like in Berlin, there's so much space which is not used usefully. So I think it's really probably a solution.
In a really crowded area, that would be the way to build like big skyscrapers of plants and fish. And then, yeah, that's good. And it's more sushi. That's really good.
For countries in arid climate with less of water could be interesting. Because I don't know if in this high temperature in summer, 45 degrees or so, if this work in summer in Tunisia or in Libya or so.
While the vegetables and fish grown by ECF are a little expensive right now, Professor Christian Ulrichs, head of the Division Urban Plant Ecophysiology at Berlin's Humboldt University, says that on a larger scale, food produced with aquaponics would become economically viable for the average Berliner.
The price on the market is about 1 euro per kilogram tomato, and ECF is calculating in the moment on their small-scale system with 5 euro per kilogram tomato. So it's relatively high, but of course they have also the additional fish production system, and I'm not sure how they calculate this. If you summarize this, well, you could say that in the moment it's not economic to do this, but if you have this on a large scale, it might become economic.
But right now, the focus of the ECF aquaponics project is to significantly reduce CO2 that's a result of food production.
In terms of our system, it's again very unique, Astaf Pro, because it allows us to have a CO2 neutral production. The CO2 that derives from the fish production, is actually it goes to the plants, and we use it as a fertilizer for the plants, so they absorb the CO2. And that way we have a CO2 neutral production.
Urban farming initiatives have been on the rise for 10 years now. Allotments are popular in Berlin and other German cities like Cologne with community-based organic farming projects. And rooftop gardens are also part of the trend. Professor Ulrichs again.
I'm very confident that we will have more systems, new systems, and very efficient systems in urban and peri-urban environments in the future.
For now, the ECF aquaponics project is still in its trial phase. But if Nicholas Leschke and his team are successful, there could be aquaponics systems sprouting up in car parks, on supermarket rooftops, and in disused factories everywhere. Cinnamon Nippard, DW, Berlin.
And you can get a look inside the aquaponics system by heading to dw.de/science. Well, we've posted a rather lovely picture gallery for you. It's quite mind-boggling, actually, so do check it out. You're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, also follow us at dw_SciTech. Well, now for the moment which we've all been waiting for, our in-depth study of the sex life of a cow. Seriously now, more than 90% of all dairy cows in Germany get pregnant without ever having had sex. They are artificially inseminated. The process has been around since the 1950s when scientists first discovered that bull semen could be frozen and defrosted. Today, as herds expand and a perceived need for efficiency increases, ever more farmers say they feel forced to invest in modern technology just to survive. Cows can now be monitored with a range of sensors that measure when the animals are in heat, as in when they are ready to conceive, and plenty more as well. Naomi Conrad visited a family-run farm near Aachen, not far from the German-Belgian border, that's embracing modern technology and the art of artificial insemination.
Perry is exceptionally good-looking. Large, dark eyes, the smallest trickle of saliva hanging from her soft black nose, her sturdy legs are folded under her shapely behind. She's won several beauty contests, both regional and national. Perry's surrounded by about 60 ever so just slightly less perfect Friesian cows, and as she calmly munches away on her midday pellets, it's easy to see why she's popular with the bulls. Only it turns out she's not. Perry's pregnant, but she's never had sex, thanks to farmer Joseph Vintjens. As he carefully sidesteps a cow pat, Vintjens points to his farmhouse, which his grandparents built in the 1930s. It's a red brick building tucked away in the fertile countryside of western Germany, some 30 kilometres from the Belgian border. In the 1990s, fresh out of farming college, Vintjens decided it was time to modernise the small dairy farm. He replaced the old barn with large, airy stables where the cows can move around freely and took a course in artificial insemination.
Well, you see, it's just more fun to milk a beautiful cow with pretty legs or a nice udder. So I started breeding cows.
But it wasn't only for the pleasure of milking beautiful cows. The farm has a milking machine. Vintjens breeds cows specifically to produce a lot of milk so he can survive in the market.
My dad never did this. He still had a bull. But you see, it's very difficult to control the calves' genetic qualities with a bull. So I started buying expensive semen and artificially inseminating the cows. And, well, I'd say my cows have turned out quite nicely.
Bulls, it has to be said, come with their dangers. They can be quite aggressive. It's one reason why they're kept apart. Do the cows miss the sex? Well, it'd be hard to ask Perry, obviously. But Professor Karl Schellender, who heads the Department of Animal Husbandry at the University of Bonn, says they probably don't.
As far as we know, cows don't have the same feelings as humans when it comes to sex. You see, cows' sexual reproduction is controlled and triggered entirely by hormones. Cats or rabbits need to mate, otherwise they don't ovulate. But cows are different.
Perry, the beautiful cow who's never had sex, slowly ambles to a feeding trough in the middle of the barn and starts munching away. When she's had her 6 kilograms of pellets, the small black sensor attached to her collar will send a signal to the computerized trough to stop it dispensing any more food. There's a second sensor on Perry's collar. It's the sex sensor.
So this is a heat time collar. It measures when the cow's in heat. Basically, it measures the cow's temperature twice a day, every morning and evening. The data's stored, and if needs be, it alerts me.
Vintjens turns the dial on a small computer screen attached to the wall of his tiny office overlooking the stables, where most of the cows are dozing in the straw. He's checking diagrams that map the condition of his cows.
So, let me check another cow. Here's a small change in temperature, but it's too insignificant. No, she's not in heat. Here's one in heat.
Once a cow's in heat, Vintjens defrosts a small packet of semen kept in a blue container of liquid nitrogen. He orders the semen from a shiny catalogue. Each page pictures a large bull in a green field and lists its genetic properties. The high-end semen Vintjens uses costs 200 euros a dose and is flown in from Canada. Vintjens carries out the artificial insemination himself. He twists the cow's tail back, cheerfully chatting away, as his entire arm disappears into the cow.
Well, yes, of course, there are nicer things to do than digging around in excrement, but someone has to do it. Pass the intestines, then you have to hold down the uterus.
And insert the semen. Vintian spent €6,500 for 20 heat-time collars for about a third of his cows. He says it's paid off. Professor Carl Schellender from the University of Bonn. He grew up on a small farm with 4 or 5 cows in the Austrian mountains.
Wir sprechen heute von precision dairy farming.
Today we tend to talk of precision dairy farming. The idea is to get objective information about every animal. So how much food does the animal eat? And when? How much water? So we've got sensors measuring the cow's temperatures, sensors measuring the acidity in a cow's stomach. Basically, this enables us to look into every animal.
But Schellender says technology, like heat time, is not the same as mass production. Schellender and farmer Vintiens talk about cow comfort, wellness farming and well-being. Vintiens is even considering buying a computer station for his farm, which would monitor his herd. But at €130,000 for 60 cows, it's an investment he's not entirely sure he can handle.
It's incredibly expensive to rent farming land nowadays. That's mainly due to biogas plants. Basically, if we can't make ends meet, we'll have to sell the farm.
Perry, meanwhile, seems blissfully unaware of her future. She will either be sold or continue to be monitored for heat, and perhaps even enjoy the convenience of artificial insemination. But real sex is definitely out of the question.
Naomi Conrad reporting there from the German-Belgian border. And if you'd like to see farmer Vintiens in the act, so to speak, we've also posted a video of artificial insemination in practice. It is at dw.de/science.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
It's no secret that you can get an app for almost just about anything these days, whether it's for dieting, exercise, menstrual cycles, or even parking. You name it, there's an app for it. Well, joining the force is a phone app which helps users look after their plants. It's the Kalbachi app. And the Swiss-based firm behind it promises that you'll never, ever again forget to water, fertilise, or mist your plants. Sounds good, doesn't it? And just a thing to test the boundaries between science and nature on a day-to-day basis. So we thought we'd conduct a little experiment of our own, and sent DW reporter and plant killer Charlotte Lormas to test the app at home. We gave Charlotte a week, just a week, to see if Kalbachi would help her flowers survive and to see whether you truly can download everything onto your phone, including green fingers, or thumbs, as the Germans put it. But relax, we've removed all of the distressing sounds like screaming daisies and creaking stems. So sit back and enjoy. And you can
life, I've managed to kill every single plant I've owned. My brother even gave me a cactus for my birthday once and said, Charlotta, at least you can't kill this one. But I did. I may have loved it a little too much and watered a plant that shouldn't be watered. Well, now I have downloaded the Kalbachi mobile phone application to see if this app can really prevent me from killing my plants. So I just bought myself a plant to test out this app on. It's a sunflower, and I've named her Sunny. Sunny looks very, very happy. Florian the florist tells me what I need to do to look after Sunny, my sunflower.
A little bit water, and not in the Halbschatten. Nicht Sun, also nicht...
Not in the direct sunlight?
Yes, yes. And when the plan... Was heißt Blüte?
The petals?
Petals? Petals is die. You are with scissors. You can
cut them off.
Cut the plant. Yes, and easy.
How much water do I give?
100 milliliter a day, more not.
Okay, so now to find out how to look after the plant. Hang on a minute. The Kalbachi app doesn't even have a sunflower listed on its plants list. What? I've checked the plants that are listed on the app and have gone and purchased myself a Marguerite chrysanthemum, otherwise known as a daisy, which I know will definitely work because it's on the list. The plant is around 12 centimetres tall, has 10 gorgeous flowers and numerous crisp green leaves. Looking at the app now, it's asking me what type of plant I have, so I select Marguerite chrysanthemum. Now the app wants to know the plant's name. I enter daisy. It wants me to select the colour and the shape of the pot for daisy, and it wants to know a delivery time for the notifications, and I tell it 7 a.m. It also wants to know my location, and it's offering me the option of a Wi-Fi plant server to analyse the temperature and light conditions of the plant. Well, I won't be buying that. Okay, done. I've saved the details of my plant daisy, and now I guess we just wait. And you can send me dead flowers every morning. Send me dead flowers by the mail. Day 2. Well, so far so good. I haven't received any notifications from Kibachi yet. When I enter the app, though, it wants to know whether the soil is moist or dry. It says misting the plant is not required, but that I will need to fertilise daisy in 4 weeks. And it tells me which fertiliser I need to buy. Good. Well, that means I'm done. Taking care of plants is turning out to be rather easy. Day 3. Still no notifications. Daisy's looking like she wants some sun or water. I can't quite tell. Her petals are starting to droop a little, to be honest. The app doesn't say whether or not my plant needs sunlight. Day 4. Still, the soil is moist, so no water for Daisy. She looks sad though, but maybe I'm just feeling that way because I feel such responsibility for her well-being. But then my friend popped over for some tea.
Your plants look really bad.
I know, I'm not quite sure what's wrong with them. I'm doing everything the app's telling me to do.
Maybe a little sun? Maybe water? These are the two most important things for plants. In Germany, you would say you don't have the green thumb, so you don't.
Day 5. Daisy is looking pretty bad, I have to say. 5 of her petals have shriveled up and are drooping. I desperately want to give her some water, but according to the app, I'm not allowed. I can't give her water unless her soil is dry, so there's not much I can do about it. I haven't received any notifications from Kibachi, and I'm seriously starting to worry about the well-being of my poor Daisy. Day 6. Daisy looks depressed. I'm devastated. Day 7. Well, Daisy's condition has seriously deteriorated. Meanwhile, Sunny the sunflower isn't looking any better than Daisy, really. I've watered Sunny 100 mils every day, like Florian the florist said to, and yet Sunny looks equally as devastating. Her leaves have curled up and adopted a jaundiced shade of yellow, and her petals are falling out. Both plants look like they're on a path towards a slow and painful death. So it looks like you can't download Green Fingers onto your phone after all. And I'm still the biggest, baddest plant murderer this side of the Southern Hemisphere.
A very sad and repentant plant murderer, Charlotte Lomas, there. Even the good grace of the Kibachi app couldn't stop her. To be fair, we should probably mention that while the app is free, you do have to pay for all the vital add-ons, so maybe that's what the trouble was, but the Spectrum budget simply wouldn't stretch to actually paying for stuff. Well, on that happy note, that is just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science and listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfikar Abani. Our studio tech was Hermann Schwieder. Up soon on Spectrum, 25 years of Pixar. Hope you can make it then. Till then, thanks for listening. Bye for now.